the second case of the morning, Agnew versus the NCAA. Ms. Fagan?
May it please the Court, Elizabeth Fagan for Plaintiffs' Appellants. This case involves a price-fixing violation under Section 1 of the Sherman Act, specifically the ability of the NCAA to keep schools from offering price discounts on the cost of bachelor's degrees in return for the student-athletes' commitments to attend member schools and provide their labor, their sport, in exchange. There are two bylaws, specific NCAA bylaws at issue. First, the bylaw that limits tuition discounts or grants an aid to 1 year. And second, the NCAA bylaw that caps tuition discounts or the amount of discounts that any one school can provide each year. Plaintiffs allege that these bylaws create a horizontal agreement on trade, a horizontal agreement not to compete on price among the member schools, and that this horizontal agreement constitutes an unreasonable restraint on trade. The district court granted the motion to dismiss of plaintiffs with prejudice. There are three issues that I'd like to cover. First, that the district court was incorrect that Banks versus NCAA requires a full rule of reason analysis here and requires dismissal in this context. Second, the district court erred in finding that plaintiffs failed to plead discernible markets. First, under the quick look rule of reason in Board of Regents from the U.S. Supreme Court, a naked restraint of trade requires no detailed market analysis and is judged under the quick look rule of reason. Second, plaintiffs do in fact plead discernible markets. First, a labor market comprised of student athletes who play their sport in exchange for their bachelor's degree in education. And second, the market for bachelor's degrees. Finally, plaintiffs
plead. What is a market for bachelor's degree?
Sure, Your Honor. The market for bachelor's degrees is the market in which schools compete to obtain students who want to go to their school and obtain their bachelor's degrees. Certainly, as the Third Circuit found in U.S. versus Brown, there is a very competitive market where schools will go and compete to obtain students to attend their four-year institutions. And the goal of students in that context is to obtain their bachelor's degrees.
Now, Brown defined the market there as the market for educational services. That's not how you phrase the market in the complaint.
That is true. We did define it a little bit differently. But certainly in this context, we have alleged that students go to the school with the intent of being there for 4 years, and that the idea is that students are committed and are committed to play their sport in exchange for being there in order to obtain a four-year degree. And in fact, that's one of the things that we allege in terms of reasonable substitutability, that outside of the NCAA, there really are no amateur sports programs where students can go and play their sports in return for obtaining their bachelor's degrees, and that they need these bachelor's degrees in the United States to get most salaried positions. And therefore, it is the bachelor's degree in which they go. However, we do think that this case is very similar to U.S. versus Brown, because in U.S. versus Brown, the Third Circuit found that this four-year education is basically what we believe to be the bachelor's degree, and any restrictions on the price that it costs to get that are subject to the antitrust laws, that those restrictions affect trade or commerce, that financial aid specifically affects the prices charged to students, and for that reason affects trade or commerce, which is subject to the antitrust laws.
Was there any particular reason why the amended complaint deemed it to be a market for the sale of bachelor's degrees versus the market for educational services?
I'm not sure it was that nuanced. I do think that we were trying to capture both the input and the output markets, and here the output market being the bachelor's degrees and the input market being the labor market for student athletes.
Right, but the output of bachelor's degrees don't follow from 4 years of playing good football or baseball or you know, there's all these other requirements that have to be met.
There certainly are other requirements, Your Honor, but I would say that if other similar cases would be the types of cases that involve professional associations and perhaps prices charged or restrictions that go into membership in professional associations. And the courts have found that in that context, even though there might be other prerequisites to being in a professional association, such as your law degree or maintaining your CLE or having your license to begin with, that doesn't mean that the ultimate price that's charged for that membership is not otherwise subject to the antitrust laws. And so here, just because a student must attend class or a student must maintain a certain GPA does not otherwise exempt the NCAA from scrutiny under the antitrust laws, and certainly doesn't provide the NCAA any type of presumption that their rules are pro-competitive.
Did you compare this to the much smaller NAIA?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
National Association of Intercollegiate Athletics.
I apologize. I didn't understand the question.
It's similar to the NCAA, but it's a group of smaller schools.
We were specifically focused on, in this context, probably the schools, most of the schools that are members of the NCAA, we allege, are those that are the top tier in terms of pro-competitiveness. And certainly here we recognize that there are certain things in the NCAA that student-athletes desire, and that is to possibly go on to the NFL in the case of football or the NBA in the case of basketball. And one of the key ways to do that is to go up through an NCAA, and particularly Division I schools. And we do recognize then that under the Board of Regents case before the U.S. Supreme Court, that the Supreme Court does recognize that there are certain types of rules that go to eligibility or go to conditions of the contest that should be judged under a full rule of reason analysis, because in that context, those rules are necessary to have the product at all, to have amateur sports at all. But what Board of Regents also teaches is that there's a second type of rule that the NCAA promulgates. And that type of rule are those that don't go to amateurism or eligibility, but in fact have a profit-making objective, and that those rules should be judged under a quick-look rule of reason. And we allege here that the district court erred by not differentiating between those two types of rules under the Supreme Court's analysis, but rather found that banks before this court, or by this court, held that all NCAA rules should be judged under a full rule of reason analysis. Yet, if you look at banks, banks was concerned with rules that were specifically focused on eligibility and amateurism, and specifically those rules that dealt with the no draft and no agent situations. But if you compare that case to the allegations that we have made here, plaintiffs have alleged that the NCAA has admitted that multi-year scholarships would actually keep the focus on amateurism. In fact, a former NCAA president has stated and admitted that athletic discounts are a device to divert the money elsewhere. And in fact, we allege that an NCAA presidential task force specifically said that under the current structure of athletics scholarships, that the focus of athletes, they may be legitimately concerned that their scholarships will be taken away if they don't exceed and excel on the field. And yet if there was a multi-year scholarship permitted, the true focus would be on amateurism, on academics, rather than a fear of losing their scholarship because they didn't play well on the field. Under that circumstance, Board of Regents should apply, and the quick look rule of reason should apply. And had the quick look rule of reason applied, plaintiffs would have survived the motion to dismiss. Under the quick look rule of reason, an agreement where there's an agreement not to compete on price in terms of price or output, there's no detailed market analysis required. Rather, plaintiffs have alleged facts of a naked restraint on price and output. And although we're accused of using legal terms of art, we allege facts in support of our allegation that these bylaws constitute a naked restraint on price and output. For example, we allege that plaintiffs who can't afford the cost of a degree without a discount and lose their scholarships may be forced to drop out. They may be forced to move schools. They're forced to pay out of pocket for their bachelor's degrees. We allege that price and output are unresponsive to consumer preference, because but for these bylaws, the NCAA schools would be forced to compete, would be forced to offer multi-year scholarships and compete on the amount of those scholarships. And so any laws or bylaws that act in contravention to consumer preference do not meet the goals of the antitrust laws.
With regard to the plaintiffs in this case, how many plaintiffs are there?
There are two.
Where did they go to school?
One went to Rice, and I'm blanking on where the other one went. Yes, thank you. And the two issues with those, they were both football players. One was injured, and one was injured as well as there was a coaching change. And as a result, although they went in with full scholarships, they were taken away from them. They were not renewed at different points in time. And we allege that at the outset, had they had the ability, based on their records, to negotiate a multi-year scholarship, that they would have gotten them and therefore are injured under the antitrust laws. I think the policy here behind the quick look rule of reason is important. As the Tenth Circuit noted, the definition of a market is a way to illuminate an anti-competitive practice. But where that anti-competitive practice is naked on its face, it's before the court on the facts, there's no need for further illumination. Rather, at that point in time, the burden should shift to the NCAA. Plaintiffs should survive the motion to dismiss. The burden should shift to the NCAA to prove a pro-competitive justification for these bylaws. I'd just like to touch briefly on the labor market, which we haven't focused on yet. We believe the district court erred because the district court literally conducted a word processing search of the complaint for the words labor or labor market and found them lacking. But yet the full detailed allegations demonstrate and allege a labor market. For example, we allege that student-athletes purchase their degrees in whole or in part with their labor, here their sport. Second, we have multiple allegations regarding the extremes that schools will go to recruit highly skilled athletes in return for their labor. And we also allege that there are no practical alternatives for students who want to go to school in exchange for playing their sports at the level that the NCAA schools play.
Do you view Banks as holding that there is no such thing as the student-athlete labor market?
I think there is dicta in Banks that certainly adverse to that, and I think that there's a well-reasoned dissent that seems to contradict that. But I think what's important is that the Banks opinion, or the Banks court, did not have the idea of these caps on years before it. It didn't have the facts that the NCAA limited these scholarships to 1 year, and certainly that makes it different from the dicta or what the court was considering there, where the court really was just noting that scholarships are limited to tuition, room, and board. And also, you know, absent restrictions, at least at this point, plaintiffs have alleged that absent these restrictions, that scholarships would purchase the labor based on supply and demand, that we don't live in a world where students pick solely because of a reputation of a school. But certainly they also pick a school because of what they're going to have to pay. Finally, Your Honors, we believe that the district court erred by dismissing the complaint with prejudice. This was the first decision on a motion to dismiss, and therefore we believe that plaintiffs should have had the opportunity at the very least to replead their complaint. Thank you.
Right. Thank you, Ms. Fagan. Mr. Kirtner.
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Gregory Kirtner. I'm appearing on behalf of the National Collegiate Athletic Association. The district court in this case, in a very careful and thoughtful opinion, got it exactly right. The plaintiffs gambled and lost. They gambled on the idea that they didn't really need to plead a relevant market. They took the words relevant market out of their amended complaint. And they gambled on the argument, on the position, that if they used the words naked restraint of price and output, that they didn't need to plead a relevant market. That's wrong as a matter of law, and the district court rejected that appropriately. Probably the best case for why that is wrong as a matter of law is Board of Regents, followed up by Cal Dental. In Board of Regents, if you go back and look at it, the two lower courts had found the NCAA rule in question there to be illegal under the per se rule. The Supreme Court, in an opinion by Justice Stevens, said it was error to use the per se rule, and you needed to use rule of reason. The word quick look is nowhere in Board of Regents. That's been what commentators have attributed it to it. And he said it's true that because the rule in question there was the television plan, which affected output markets, which affected commercial markets for the sale of football games to TV networks, that it was not the kind of thing that you ordinarily worry about with NCAA rules, which do, and they do say that they're presumed to be valid. Because it was a naked restraint on output and a restraint on price in a commercial market, they said that even then we need to apply the rule of reason. And they applied it perhaps a little quicker than they might have in other cases, but they did apply the full rule of reason. There was a market in that case, properly alleged, properly proved, properly found by the district court, and approved by the Court of Appeals. And there were anti-competitive effects in that market. Output was reduced. The test for anti-competitive effects, the sine qua non, is whether there is a reduction in output that harms consumers in some conceivable relevant market. Output is the critical question. And if there was any doubt about the proper reading of Board of Regents after Banks, the Supreme Court answered it in Cal Dental. Cal Dental, the Federal Trade Commission, went after some rules of the California Dental Association, which on their face did seem like they restrained output. They said, you may not price advertise. On their face, they looked pretty suspicious. When it got to the Supreme Court, they reversed the Ninth Circuit and said, we can think of pro-competitive reasons for these rules. Therefore, quick look was error. Therefore, you need to go back and assess whether there's a relevant market and whether there are adverse effects on output in that relevant market. That is clearly the right result. That's the same result from this court in Banks and from this court in the two opinions in Chicago Professional Sports. Counsel alluded to, in the court below at least, the first opinion in Chicago Professional Sports, where this court did apply what it said was a quick look. But by the time of the second opinion in Chicago Professional Sports, Judge Easterbrook said we have to go for a full rule of reason, given the circumstances of the rule. And that was a rule that clearly limited output of TV broadcasts.
All right. May I ask if you, if we don't take a quick look and we apply full rule of reason analysis, do you concede there is a market for educational services, as the Brown University case seemed to hold?
Not on this, on these pleadings, Your Honor.
Right. So you can disagree with regard to the whether the amended complaint adequately stated that market, but do you concede as a general matter that there is a market for educational services?
No, I do not. There might be. Remember that Brown University involved a challenge to the overlap rules of the Ivy League schools and MIT. The market alleged there was simply the Ivy Leagues and MIT, and it was said that they were in a unique and distinct market. Maybe they were. There were allegations there of a distinct and independent relevant market, and there were allegations of a reduction in output in that market, which could be tested. We don't have anything like that here. Rather, what we have is this amorphous idea of bachelor's degrees in every school in the United States, and how a few athletic scholarships, one way or the other, could affect the market for bachelor's degrees in the United States is inconceivable.
Okay, yeah, so that last point doesn't, though, dispute the notion that there is indeed a market for educational services. So, for example, could all the universities in the United States get together and set tuition?
I would think the answer to that is probably no.
Okay.
But again, it would require it to be tested with an allegation of a relevant market. Now, there may be alternatives. There are alternatives to everything, including bachelor's degrees from all universities in this country. You can go to Canada. You can go to Europe. You can go to junior college. You can go to community college. If the price of bachelor's degrees, whatever the price of a bachelor degree means, were to go up too far, people would shift to alternatives. And so you need to apply a relevant market test even in that hypothetical, which is extreme, I concede, that how many people would go to a substitute? How many people would go to junior college or community college or work at McDonald's or do something else, get their degrees online from the University of Phoenix instead of getting these bachelor's degrees? That is a question which requires an appropriate allegation of a relevant market, and an appropriate allegation of what the substitutes are, how close they are, what the cross-elasticities are, the hypothetical monopolist test. There are all these ways of doing these things. This group of plaintiffs, these two plaintiffs and their lawyers, chose not to do any of that. So whatever the hypotheticals might be, they are not present here. The labor market, and I hope I've responded to your question, but the labor market is equally, is even more far-fetched. It was not pled. It's not in there in any way. To go out and make it up for them would be to go beyond what I think an appropriate role for the courts is. But banks does deal with that issue as to whether there's an appropriate labor market. The allegations were better there. But I think that the holding in banks is still good law, even though it's a well-written dissent. The intervening period of time, 20 years, only shows that the majority was correct, because we've got Cal Dental, we've got Twombly, and we've got Iqbal. You cannot simply make some suggestion that there's some amorphous labor market out there without
Twombly,
supporting it.
Excuse me for a moment. Twombly and Iqbal had to do with parallel conduct and whether or not the allegations were sufficient to allege an agreement. There's no doubt that there's an agreement by the NCAA member institutions here, right?
Well, we haven't contested that issue. We have in some other cases, but that's not the issue here. But I do think the court went out of its way in Twombly and Iqbal to say that they were not limiting their holdings to the specific facts in those cases. They said that you have to allege facts, not conclusions.
So in the banks case did not deal with the caps on the number of either years or the number of scholarships.
That's correct. It dealt with the no draft and no agent rules, but it found that those were eligibility rules of the kind the Supreme Court said were presumed to be valid in Board of Regents. And the one-year scholarship rule here is equally an eligibility rule. It decides what kind of aid is appropriate. It defines an appropriate grant and aid, which is essentially an eligibility term. There are many pro-competitive justifications for both of these rules, I don't need to really go into them given the lack of adequate pleading here, but I'm happy to do so. The one-year rule cannot on its face have an adverse effect on output. If you take a scholarship away from one student-athlete in their third year, you give it to somebody else. The number of scholarship years is going to remain the same. You're substituting people, no doubt about that. But that's not an anti-competitive effect. That's not a concern of the anti-competitive laws. That's not an output restriction. The cap on the number of scholarships, 85 in football, 13 in basketball, different numbers in different sports, is in one sense a cap on an input. And you would ordinarily under the antitrust laws say we look at these kinds of caps carefully. Here, neither of these plaintiffs alleges that they were harmed by the 85 cap in football, and they weren't. That's a given. And some rule is necessary for team sports. In Board of Regents, the court said that you must agree in league sports, you must agree on the number of players on the team, on a team. That's a quote. And that's essentially got to be true, right? And just as you agree on the number who can be on the field at any given time, number who can be substituted at any given time, the number of coaches that you can have is always agreed upon, and that's been approved in the Hennessy decision. The number of total players on the travel squad, the number of players that can be recruited in the first year, you must agree on all these sorts of things. And whether the cap is 85, 75, or 105 is well within the range of decision-making of the academic and athletic people who make these decisions. What the court in Board of Regents called the ample latitude for the decision-makers in league sports to do these sorts of things. So there clearly are rational reasons, pro-competitive justifications here. That's enough to get you past the sort of conclusion that this looks like or is said to look like a naked restraint on something. And given that, and given the law in Cal Dental Banks and all the other cases, there is no good law that says you have to apply a quick look here, and it would have been error to do so. The district court also did not err in denying leave to amend. They amended once with our consent. They chose to delete allegations of relevant market. And what, as a defendant, are you supposed to do when a plaintiff deletes relevant market? Are you not entitled to rely on that? Certainly you are. And so what they said, what Mr. Berman told the district court, was, frankly, Your Honor, we didn't spend much time on relevant market because of their quick look theory. And when she pushed him a little bit more on that, he said, we did the best we could. And so they had a chance to amend a second time after we filed our second motion to dismiss. They chose not to. They went ahead with the hearing. Under the rule, they had the right to amend. And they didn't file, after the court ruled against them and dismissed with prejudice, they didn't file a motion for leave to amend to say how they would amend. And we still don't have any answer as to what they would do, how they would plead an appropriate market. And I don't think you can on these facts. You know, the Ivy Leagues are different than the Big Ten, than the SEC, in terms of their academic qualifications, of their athletic qualifications. They're different than Division II, different than Division III. What the cross-elasticities, what the substitutions are matters that have to be pled. They cannot just be assumed. Does the court have any further questions? I appreciate the court's time. Thank you.
Thanks, Gertner. Ms. Agnew?
I have just a couple of follow-up points. First, with respect to plaintiff's initial amendment, the only things that were removed were the heading 4 entitled Relevant Market and one sentence that said that relevant market is the market for bachelor's degrees. All of the facts that we allege that would support that legal conclusion remain in the complaint. Second, Regents says only that NCAA restrictions that preserve the integrity of amateurism can be viewed as anti-competitive or pro-competitive. There is no must, as the NCAA would have this court find. And in Regents, although the court found ultimately that market power had been proven, not just alleged, but proven, the court held as a matter of law that it did not need to analyze market power because the horizontal restraints at issue were anti-competitive on their face. The Supreme Court found that as a matter of law. Finally, in Chicago professional sports, this court has previously noted that in applying the rule of reason, the court asks whether practice produces net benefits for consumers. It is no answer, as the NCAA claims, to say that a loss is reasonably small. Therefore, we ask that the court reverse the district court's decision on the motion to dismiss.
Thank you, Ms. Fagan, and thanks to all counsel. The case will take under advisement.